Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Political philosophy and one's education, both formal and informal, can lead a person on unimagined paths that are often woven into stories in that person's later life. The book, Radical, A Memoir of Wars, Communists, and Work, was written by Mel Fiske, our guest in this edition of Radio Curious. Mel Fiske was radicalized after a 15,000-mile journey across America during the Depression of the 1930s while he was a journalism student in Ohio, fulfilling his youthful ambition to become a newspaper man. That trip opened his eyes to life and work he never knew existed after growing up in New York City. I spoke with Mel Fiske on January 12, 2006, from his home in Northern California about these experiences and how they formed his belief of how society should be. I asked him to describe the working conditions he experienced during that time.
I began working on railroads, particularly, back in 1942 or 3, if I remember rightly. But before that, I had been a student university student in Ohio, and had also gone on a summer jaunt through the United States, which opened my eyes to the plight of the homeless and unemployed and the working man.
I'd like you to describe that.
Well, that was a very formative part of my growth.
What did it do for you? What was formed?
I saw the country. I saw the country in agony. I couldn't understand why there was so much agony, why there was so much unemployed, why there were so many strikes and so much bitterness amongst the labor people that I ran into on this jaunt. It was taken with four other college kids. It involved the whole summer of 1939. And at the end of that, we wrote a book, which was published in 1940, called The Argonauts, and had a tremendous sale of 620 copies. For me, the book itself is a part of my living history to help me to grapple with the economic problems and help me try to understand how to solve them.
Well, as a former member of the Communist Party and an active political observer for many years, what are your thoughts about the reasons why the labor struggles and the political struggles were what they were? What were their causes in that period of time? And this is the several years prior to World War II, the late 30s and the early 40s.
Yes, it was during the Depression. And the Depression, of course, had depressed one quarter, actually, of the working population of the country. They were unemployed, and they were hungry, and they were, in many cases, homeless, living in these so-called Hoovervilles, the cardboard shacks that ringed many, many cities that I saw on this trip through the country. And so there was great unrest, there was great unhappiness, there was great despair, and people didn't know what the hell to do or how to do it. And the only apparent voice, or the loudest voice, was the Communist Party. I was intrigued by this whole business of trying to pull the country out with its bootstraps. So I joined the Communist Party, trying to help alleviate many of the problems of the country.
Can you describe the hopes and ideals of the American Communist Party during that time?
There was no, as far as I could tell, no link with Bolsheviks in the Soviet Union. I could see none of that. In the main, the Communist Party of the United States attempted to solve the major economic problems of the people of this country and tried to outline a program that would give a role to the workers, to those people who needed housing, those people who needed some security. They led the fight for Social Security, for the establishment of Social Security, which didn't exist at that time. Led the fight for rent control, which didn't exist at that time.
Why do you think that there became a fear, a loathing, a hatred by some people of the word communist and people affiliated with that philosophy?
Well, it was a scary proposition for the people who owned the country, the so-called capitalists. The major one, of course, was J. Edgar Hoover. There was a great propaganda drive to make the communists, the people who were being beaten over the head and were derided, were maligned, were ostracized, made them hated. The miners in the 1880s who struck for their demands were derided as Bolsheviks and communists as well. I guess it's comparable to what we today consider the terrorists. The terrorists are the communists, were the communists of the past.
You had training as a journalist at the University of Ohio.
I wanted to be a journalist from the age of 12.
Why?
Oh, it was an exciting craft, and I read books by many of the major journalists of the time, and they were foreign correspondents, and they tramped all over the world hunting up stories, and that sounded exciting, and that sounded rewarding. I trained myself to be a journalist. I lived in a household where they spoke Yiddish, and I didn't know too much English, and I had to live with a dictionary beside me for a long time. I became a newspaper reporter on small newspapers, daily newspapers, one in particular in Welch, West Virginia, where it was an exciting time. I covered two major mine explosions in one year. The United Mine Workers was a struggling young organization. At the time, they were trying desperately to get the mine safety into line. There were no mine safety codes at the time. John O. Lewis was stridently attempting to get Congress to adopt mining legislation. They resisted, because of the huge lobby that the mine owners had, even then at that time. The mine explosion caused great grief through the whole area and perhaps the whole country. It wasn't on TV like this January mine explosion was. It was reported in newspapers. There were hundreds of newspapermen around.
In this edition of Radio Curious, we're talking with Mel Fisk from his home in Marin County, California. Mel Fisk is the author of Radical, a memoir of wars, communists, and work. Mel Fisk, at some point, you chose not to pursue your training and your career as a journalist and instead went to work in steel mills. Why did you do that?
I decided that I wanted to get down into the nitty-gritty. Instead of reporting on workers, I decided to go into work itself. I think the first job I had was at the Kelly Springfield Tire Company as what is known as a bead boy, and that was in Cumberland, Maryland. I got fired out of that job a few days when the FBI came around, I think, and told them that whom they had hired. At any rate, I went and got another job in the Western Maryland Railroad yards, fixing watching fire break in the inside of locomotives when the locomotives were in Roundhouse. Well, this is a job that has since long since disappeared, and because railroad locomotives themselves have disappeared, and roundhouses have disappeared, right now with the diesel engines, you have to be an engineer who understands motors instead of steam. So, at any rate, I spent some time on the railroad in the roundhouse, climbing into the bellies of the steam engines, chipping out old, broken-down fire brick that lines the insides of steam engines, and replacing them. It was new brick. It was a claustrophobic kind of job, and I wasn't too unhappy to get fired from that.
Mel, you were working with a black man in the roundhouse.
Yes. Yeah.
And you had some interesting sociological exchanges with him about race.
Yes.
What were they?
He was an older man. His name was Robert. And been raised in Cumberland. And he had worked on the Western Maryland Railroad for many, many years, watching white people, younger men, jump over him in seniority. And here he was, an experienced railroad worker, he was a kind of a fitter. He knew his engines. He knew how to fix him up, and he was pushed aside by these younger white people. Well, he was very resentful of that, and
he was pushed aside because he was black?
Yes, yeah, exactly, and he knew it, and so he was resentful of that, and he was. After a while, as you age, you accept many things, and he did. He wasn't about to fight. He had this job. It was a kind of a sinecure. He worked on that job for many, many, many years.
You're a person who has observed American history and American culture for the past 80-plus years with a particular political bent. What do you think was the cause of the discrimination that he and others suffered at that time?
It was great discrimination against blacks all through the country. Lynchings were rife. Robert was the guy who worked on this railroad, was the son of a coal miner, because Maryland was a big coal mining area as well. As a son of a coal miner, he took the first job he could get as a black man, and that was on the railroad.
And that's where he stayed.
And that's where he stayed. He was unwilling to go into the mines, as his father had done. He knew how dangerous it was under the conditions that existed in the Maryland mines at that time. He was a very, very sharp and smart man to avoid it.
Mel Fisk, after you worked in the railroad, you went on to work in the steel mills.
Right.
How was that different from a political or sociological perspective?
Well, from my point of view, it was very, very different. I found that I was unable to find any jobs at all in the Cumberland, Maryland region, because every time I found a job, the FBI was there to make sure that I was fired. So I went to Baltimore. I didn't know how much time I would have, but I went to the Sparrows Point Bethlehem Steel Mill and found a job there. A very strange job. It was at the end of the mill itself. The steel rolled was rolled out into the mill and down into a coiling pit, and that's where I worked, at the coiling pit. The conditions were harsh. This was in the winter time, and the winds were roaring through this huge shed, and it was cold and freezing, and the steel was rolled at tremendous heat, and when it came down, roaring down into the coiling pit, the heat itself was so intense that it warmed the whole pit. Actually, the steel was, some 2,000 degrees. It was very warm, and we had to mark the coils so that they could be assembled later when they cooled. So it was a very intense kind of job. There were hundreds and hundreds of people in the mill, and each department was kind of separate. So I really, in a sense, didn't get any idea of what was happening, except when there was one time when some guy fell into the vat in which the steel, when it had to be cleaned, was dipped. It was an acidic vat, and the steel was dipped into it. It was very, very dangerous, hard work there. Some guy fell into this vat and was eaten alive by this acidic flow, and then upset the whole mill at the time. I don't think anything was done with it. The union did undertake some action. The union itself was struggling to maintain itself.
Mel Fisk, author of Radical, A Memoir of Wars, Communists, and Work. Is there a section of your book that you could read for us?
This section that I'm about to read is probably my introduction to the steel mill itself. I was given a job, and here's what it was. I stood on the platform with the pole, nervously eyeing the other end of the track, the dark hulk of huge rollers through which the slabs of red-hot ingots were compressed into a thin, continuous sheet. Each sheet was 200 yards long, 5 feet across, wide as the track of rollers, and a quarter inch thick. The fiery end of what looked like a ribbon emerged from the mill rollers as if squirted from a water nozzle. It roared along the track, undulating and swelling like a live prehistoric monster. I poked my pole down on the rearing head. It ducked into the coiling pit and clattered around until it was tightly wound, like a roll of toilet paper, I thought. And then, still red hot, the spool of steel was pushed by a giant prod out of the pit and onto a moving conveyor belt. I just had time to get my pole in the air before the next steel sheet came pounding down the track. I touched its tip as it came toward me. Into the pit it went. All it needed was a touch. No brute force, nothing to it. I glanced down at the coil being upended and pushed onto the conveyor, and then braced myself for the next lunging streak. The rhythm was set by the button pusher in the pulpit. He controlled the opposing rollers that squeezed the red slab thin, and when it was the required 1/4 inch, he released it to race down the track. I adjusted to his pace. I responded to the sounds, rumbled in the distance, deep growl on the track, roar as the steel ribbon came close. Down flicked the pole, clackety clacking like a rushing subway train. The ribbon wound itself up. Over the track I stood as if on a chariot and plunged my lance into the bodies of the charging dragons. Each red fire breather acquired its own personality as it slid it on its belly toward me. One was the pained face of the Union President's subordinate who had fired me. Another, the tanned and wrinkled face of the Marine warrant officer who made life hell on the troop transport. Another took the shape of the redhead wife who wrote me 900 letters during the 1,000 days I island hopped in the Pacific. Rumble, growl, roar, pow.
Mel Fisk, author of Radical, a memoir of wars, communists, and work, I want to thank you very much for joining us on Radio Curious. And before we close, can you tell us about an interesting book that you've read lately?
I have been immersed in a book called Bayou Farewell by Mike Tidwell. And he wandered through the bayous 3-4 years ago and found that it was crumbling into the Gulf and predicted what exactly happened after the hurricane of Katrina. And it's a fascinating and very compelling book.
Mel Fisk, thank you very much for joining us on Radio Curious.
Thank you. Thank you, Barry.
Mel Fisk is the author of Radical, a memoir of wars, communists, and work. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious can be found on our website, www.radiocurious.org. They're also available in CD format. At Radio Curious, we appreciate your thoughts and ideas about our programming and enjoy hearing from you. Our address is Post Office Box 7, Ukiah, that's UKIAH, California, 95482. Our email address is curious@radiocurious.org. You've been listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Thank you for joining us.